Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Today, the place of religion in state schools with Australia's Humanist of the Year. But first, do you remember the Deneira boys? In September 1940, the ship HMT Deneira arrived in Sydney carrying 2,500 German and Austrian men who'd been transported from England not as refugees but as interned enemy aliens. The strange story of their incarceration in camps at Hay and Tatura is both appalling and inspirational. Here, historian Ken Inglis talks about the research he's been doing for his book on the Deneira boys, whom he recalls as an exotic bunch of teachers, fellow students and convivial companions at the University of Melbourne in the late 1940s. The youngest of the boys are now in their mid-80s, but their extraordinary story has been recorded, capturing the memories of survivors and their families. Ken Inglis AO is Emeritus Professor of History at the Australian National University. His books include The Stuart Case, This is the ABC, Who's ABC, and Sacred Places. And this lecture was recorded at the State Library of Victoria.
What we're looking at is the front page of a remarkable publication. Between the masthead and the image, there's a carefully composed sentence. It says, "This is a publication for former refugees from Nazi and fascist persecution, mistakenly shipped to and interned in Australia at Hay and Tatura, many later serving with the Allied forces, their relatives and their friends." Inset in the title is a photograph of the hired military transport Deneira, which sailed from Liverpool on the 10th of July 1940, bound for ports in Australia, and carrying some 2,500 such refugees, all of them male, who'd been rounded up in Britain, mistakenly, as the British government was to admit. The ship was terribly overcrowded, and the internees were undernourished, bullied, robbed, and generally maltreated by their British guards. The internees are said to have been refugees from both Nazi and fascist persecution. In May and June 1940, when a German invasion of Britain was believed to be imminent, the authorities ordered the capture, that was the word used, capture, of all male enemy aliens between the ages of 16 and 60. A large majority were Germans and Austrians, but some were Italians, who had by definition become enemy aliens when Mussolini declared war on the 10th of June. Most of them were Jews. Some were disembarked at Melbourne and dispatched by train to Tatura. Most were carried on to Sydney and put on trains for Hay, where they remained for about 8 months before they too were taken to Tatura. For many years, the body that published the Deneira News was called the Hay Tatura Association. It became the Deneira Association only when there were very few survivors still alive. That passage says, "many later serving with the Allied forces." Those words cover two distinct categories of camp inmates. In 1941 and 1942, male internees were offered two ways out of the camps. They could return to Britain and join a pioneer corps in the British Army, or they could be released from Tatura into a unit called the 8th Employment Company of the Australian Military Forces. Eventually, more than half the internees were repatriated to England and other countries, including the USA and Palestine, on the eve of becoming Israel, while about 900 opted to stay in Australia. Among the returners, many who'd left Europe as refugees entered their countries of birth in British uniforms, having been transferred from the Pioneer Corps to fighting units. Walter Freud, grandson of Sigmund, aged 19 when captured, left Tatura for Britain in July 1941. Early in 1945, he parachuted into Austria, where he single-handedly captured a Nazi airfield, holding up the commander at pistol point and arresting him in the name of the Royal Air Force. A gratifying way, I'm sure you'll agree, for a Freud to return to his native land. No such heroics, indeed no military activities whatever, were possible for the members of the 8th Employment Corps. They were a labour corps, not allowed to bear arms, though as some remarked wryly, they did carry ammunition, lugging boxes of it from Victorian to New South Wales trains at the break of gauge in Albury. Although hardly any of them managed to enlist in the fighting army, the AIF, they preferred army camps to barbed wire compounds, no longer mere enemy aliens, but members of the Australian military forces. From the moment the internees landed, they discovered that the Australian soldiers guarding them were altogether more amiable than the sadistic ruffians on the Deneira. The commanding officer of the 8th Employment Company, Captain Edward Broughton, was deeply respected, even revered, by his men. Broughton came from New Zealand and was part Maori. He'd put his age up to get to the war in South Africa at the turn of the century, served on Gallipoli in World War I, and put his age down to enlist for World War II. He was a Catholic, although apparently not a very observant one. The majority of his men, possibly as many as 80%, were Jews. It was the most Jewish army unit in the world, someone suggests. Broughton was responsive far beyond the call of duty to the dietary and other ritual requirements of the more orthodox among the men, and he was sympathetically curious about their faith and their traditions. He remained a strict disciplinarian. "Those who want special leave for Rosh Hashanah," he bellowed, "will not obtain passes for Yom Kippur." There would be a huge and unforeseen consequence of their military service. Hundreds would become eligible for the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme, enabling them as ex-servicemen to get a higher education otherwise beyond their reach. Back to the Deneira News. This issue is number 79. At the top of the next page appear the words, "Foundation Editor, the late Henry Lipman, OAM. This is a tribute to a man who was dedicated to preserving and transmitting the collective memory of internees. Henry Lipman, formerly Heinz, was an 18-year-old Jewish Berliner who'd escaped to England just before the war began and was the only member of his family who survived the Holocaust. After the war, he was given a job in Sydney by a Jewish businessman who was also from Berlin. He made a career in the fashion industry. The Deneira News was launched in 1984, largely on Henry Lipman's initiative. It began as a modest newsletter and has burgeoned as a journal of reminiscence and reflection, a record of lives and deaths, and a conduit to former shipmates around the world. These days, its professional appearance, its accessibility online, and a good deal of the editing is the doing of descendants of internees. Henry Lipman has been succeeded as editor by Mike Sondheim, formerly Gunther Sondheim. Born in Dusseldorf 93 years ago, began engineering studies in Zurich and completed them as a CRTS student in Melbourne. He's retired twice and described himself in 2002 as devoting time to family, travel, golf, and last, not least, the Deneira Association. He has a prodigious memory. I tingle with historian's delight as I send off to Mike Sondheim some query about events 60 and 70 years ago, sure of a quick and illuminating response. That label Deneira Boys, popularly attached to the internees, may mislead us into imagining that they were all young. Hirschfeld Mack was 47 when he was captured, and some were nearer 60. For those in their teens and 20s, the experience of incarnation could be an adventure. Older men, many of whom had had to leave wives and children behind, were perhaps more likely to share the sense of desolation Hirschfeld Mack expresses here. Ludwig Hirschfeld Mack had worked at the Bauhaus, the famous incubator of modernism, from its beginnings in the Weimar of 1919. The Bauhaus credo was that the artist is an exalted craftsman. Hirschfeld Mack took up the art and craft of printmaking and worked at that with, among others, Vasily Kandinsky and Paul Klee. He was close to Walter Gropius, founder of the Bauhaus, who later did his best to get him to the USA. In Hay and Tatura, he produced numerous woodcuts portraying camp life, and he initiated younger artists into the medium of woodcuts before being released in March 1942 and put in charge of art at Geelong Grammar School. One of his pupils, who became an art gallery director, Daniel Thomas, says of him, "Hirschfeld gave me my first schoolboy glimpse of the wild enchantments of art." Other artists and potential artists gathered around the German surrealist painter Hein Heckroth, who became famous in England after the war, when he did the designs for the classic ballet film by Michael Powell, and Emmerich Pressburger, The Red Shoes. Among the circle around Heckroth were two artists, both of them Berliners, who were still at work in 2011, the painter Klaus Friedeberger in London and the sculptor and graphic artist Erwin Fabian in London and Melbourne. Music flourished in the camps. So did poetry. So did learning. There's a vivid account of cultural life in Hay in the journal Historical Studies by Klaus Lerwald, a Berliner aged 19 when captured, who later became an American diplomat, then an Australian academic, and in retirement, a neighbour of mine in Canberra. A camp school was organised, Lerwald writes, as were individual lecture series, clubs and sport teams. Religious services were held. I'm still quoting Klaus Lerwald. Individual artists began to paint, sculpt, compose and perform. A stage group and a choir were formed and a chamber orchestra. Church groups helped, and so did other benevolent societies and individuals, sending a piano, string instruments, printed music, books in several languages, instruments to aid in the study of technical subjects. Klaus Lerwald goes on, I lived in a fairly intellectual hut. Among its inhabitants there were a painter, two philologists, a Catholic research scholar, one of a trio of brilliant young conversationalists whom I'd admired on board ship, an aspiring young poet who'd been at Oxford when interned, some men with business backgrounds, and my friend Egon, a sheet metal worker. The philologists became camp school teachers of English and the classical languages. The brilliant conversationalist taught Italian. I took his course, says Lerwald. The budding young poet got up at 2 a.m. to compose by moonlight stanzas reminiscent of Rilke. Egon, the sheet metalist, took lessons in drafting. Most of those who didn't teach took one course or another. A distinguished musician and pianist, he goes on, Peter Stadlen, who'd been well known in Berlin, gave piano recitals and conducted choral works, which he transposed for male voices only and for such instruments as were available. This choir's repertory ranged from Austrian folk songs to Handel's oratorio Israel in Egypt. Imagine that, Israel in Egypt, sung by a mostly Jewish choir, exiled in a land which to European eyes was a desert. And there were sports, especially for the younger men, including soccer and a game called handball. Some young men were taught to throw the javelin by Franz Stampfl, an athletics coach who'd thrown one for Austria in the Berlin Olympics of 1936. Stampfl would coach, as many of you will remember, Roger Bannister in 1954 when he ran in Oxford the world's first four-minute mile. And in 1956, Stampfl would coach 11 of the Australian competitors in the Melbourne Olympics. When the Hay internees were moved to the greener landscape of Tatura in May 1941, they found a similar range of cultural activities well established. Here they could roll in the Collegium Taturense, that Latin title affirming a serious mission to transplant the culture of Berlin and Vienna in the Australian bush. Many of the courses on offer at Hay and Tatura were vocational, designed to fit men for whatever life after internment was going to be. Cultural life in the camps is among aspects of the internees' stories recorded in three valuable books. The De Nera Internees by Benzie and Patkin, 1979, The De Nera Scandal by Cyril Pearl, 1983, and The De Nera Affair, a documentary resource book by Paul Bartrop and Gabriel Eisen, 1990, which is a well-stocked do-it-yourself research kit awaiting users. Why have I decided to write a book on the subject? Most obviously because it's 20 years since the last of those titles was published. A lot of new material has come to light in the last two decades. Diaries, letters, memoirs published and unpublished, memorabilia. I have a more personal reason for wanting to take up the story. Returning to Melbourne recently after about 50 years away and remembering my childhood and youth in this city, I found myself thinking of De Nera boys I'd known here. Of all the marvels awaiting a 17-year-old lad from the suburbs at the University of Melbourne in 1947, none has stayed more vividly with me than the presence of these exotic Europeans. Queen's College, the University of Melbourne, where I lived, had three, and it was probably there that I first heard the word De Nera. Dr. George Duerheim, a graduate in medicine from the great University of Vienna, was having to slog through three more years of study before he was deemed fit to practice in this country. Dr. Leonard Adams' doctorate was in law from the University of Berlin, In the Weimar years, he was a judge and a lecturer in ethnological jurisprudence and primitive law. Oxford gave him refuge. Penguin published in 1940 his book Primitive Art, which remained for decades a standard work. In Tatura, he was pro-rector of the Collegium Taturensi. He was among men at Tatura released in response to appeals to the authorities by people, mainly women, in philanthropic and civil libertarian agencies, including the student Christian movement. He lived in Queen's College until he married in 1943 Mary Bailey, a musician and secretary of a Refugees Internees Assistance Committee, who'd been involved in sending to Hay and then to Tura pianos for the use of Peter Stadlen. Stadlen was well known as a performer in Berlin when Leonard Adams' Australian wife was studying piano in Europe under Arthur Schnabel and Wilhelm Backhaus. By my time in Queens, Dr. Adam was living in Brighton with his wife and their daughter, using Queens as a convenient and academically congenial place to dine. Professor Max Crawford had given him a billet in the university's history department, where he created a tiny museum and delivered sparsely attended lectures in anthropology, a subject not otherwise represented at the university. George Nadel, from Vienna, was an undergraduate student of history, living in Queens. He was 23 in 1947. To us younger students in Queens, he seemed disconcertingly mature and learned. He had a dazzling proficiency in the analytic thinking required for the subject theory and method of history, a joint enterprise of historians and philosophers which flourished in Melbourne. He would go to the USA, marry a Rockefeller, and establish his own journal, History and Theory, which became and remains essential reading for scholars in the interdisciplinary field its editor had first encountered here in Melbourne. Three of the Melbourne philosophers in my time, Kurt Beyer, Peter Herbst and Gerd Buchtel, were De Niro boys, and so were two of their pupils, Henry Mayer and Hugo Wolfson, who were taking philosophy subjects as part of their honours courses in political science. To callow classmates, Mayer and Wolfson were a fearsome pair, prowling the old arts building and the union like bears, hungry to feast on our dogmas and confusions, especially those deriving from Karl Marx. If, as Mayer later alleged, Stalinists in Hay beat him up and smashed his glasses, he was more than getting even. It was a historic moment in pre-multicultural Melbourne, pre-multicultural Australia, when Mayer and a young pre-war refugee from Breslau, Max Corden, jointly edited the annual Melbourne University magazine in 1949. Herbst, Buchtel and Beyer all performed outstandingly in the Honours School of Philosophy and were on their way to academic careers in four continents. Beyer, from Vienna, captivated students by his un-Australian urbanity, his incisiveness and wit. Peter Herbst, dashingly handsome from Heidelberg via a posh English public school, excited and bewildered students in tutorials by his teasing speculations, his pregnant Wittgensteinian silences and his appreciative chuckles. To the young Vincent Buckley, he was the form of the civilised and civilising European. Herbst, like Nadel, Beyer, Mayer and Wolfson, had reached the university by grace of the Commonwealth Reconstruction Training Scheme. Gerd Buchtel paid his own way through a philosophy degree. Living in England as a refugee from the Rhineland city of Mainz, he'd qualified as an engineer, while his brother Hans took a brilliant degree in physics at the Imperial College of Science and Technology in London. Gerd and Hans Buchtel were among the first internees to leave Tatura when the authorities began late in 1941 to release internees for work deemed to be of national importance. In Melbourne, Buchtel created the subject History and Philosophy of Science. His bold commitment to the bridging of disciplines, encouraged both by the structure of courses and by the intellectual climate. He would later introduce that subject to Cambridge. And I remember him and Peter Herbst recalling what seemed to me the most enthralling part of the De Niro story. In the long and disagreeable weeks at sea, internees found a variety of ways to pass the time. Many played cards. Some played chess with chessmen made from the ships and palatably doughy bread. Orthodox Jews gathered around rabbis to read and interpret the Torah. A cantor from Berlin formed a choir fit for a synagogue. People of more secular bent set up classes and discussion groups. Gerd Buchtel and Peter Herbst, with a young Berliner named Peter Lasky, composed a constitution designed to order life in whatever place of confinement lay ahead. Buchtal wrote it in German on toilet paper, having somehow scrounged a whole roll of that scarce and rationed commodity. That document, now among treasured relics in Melbourne's Jewish Museum, embodied a commitment to parliamentary democracy and a determination to construct checks and balances against tyranny. It was a blueprint for a secure liberal state, like England's, which would avoid the fate of Weimar. In Hay and Tatura, the three authors would engage in debates, tolerated and even encouraged by their jailers, about how best to have the occupants of each hut represented in camp-wide parliaments and what powers those bodies should be given over the inmates' lives. Behind the barbed wire, 2,500 Europeans were living in a condition rather like what philosophers have called a state of nature. Communists, social democrats, liberals, Orthodox Jews and mavericks collaborated and contended to devise instruments for what we might now call the governance of civil society. Each camp became, in Klaus Löwold's phrase, a small working republic. Were the De Niro boys I knew typical? There is no typical De Niro boy, says one survivor, himself an intellectual, to outsiders who may imagine that they were all academics and artists. Certainly they were more diverse than I knew. I used to sit on Fleur chairs and ate at Fleur tables. Perhaps some of you did too in the 50s. Unaware, I was, that the film making these items of modernist furniture took its name from the initials of two De Niro internees, the Berliner Fred Lohan, FL, and the Viennese Ernst Roddick, ER. A survey conducted in Hay to ascertain how many internees would be of use to the war effort found 20 doctors and 21 motor mechanics, 27 lawyers and 30 leather workers, 20 journalists and 22 textile workers, 27 artists and 28 butchers. Of the 900 who stayed in Australia, uncounted numbers moved to new occupations, their aspirations encouraged by the openness of Australian society to talented and determined newcomers. There are celebrated cases of De Niro boys making their way into places hitherto the preserve of an Anglo-Celtic establishment. Herbert Bayer from Berlin became the first Jew admitted to the Melbourne Stock Exchange. Gerald Cunningham, formerly Kuppenheim of Pforzheim, was elected to the committee of the Victoria Racing Club. His father had been on the committee of the Baden-Baden Racing Club, and he was on the committee of the Victoria Racing Club. But Douglas Berner, a motor mechanic in London, became a motor mechanic in Alice Springs. Roy Talheimer, whose father had once been the chief theoretician of the German Communist Party, lived in obscurity as a worker for the Victorian Forestry Commission. The only noteworthy event in his life, Roy Talheimer tells people, happened in Moscow in 1924 when he sat on Lenin's widow's knee in the Kremlin. How many other De Niro boys, I wonder, have disappeared from public view, and what do they think and feel about their experience? If it's safe to generalise from ones I've known, De Niro boys don't share, by and large, the indignation expressed by some people who've written and talked about their experience. To be sure, capture was a shock. The voyage was arduous, and life in the camps and the army was no picnic. But the providence that submitted them to those hardships eventually gave them freedom. Compare those hardships, as De Niro boys did later, with the fate of friends and relatives trapped in Europe, transported in cattle trucks to the gas chambers. Compare also, for that matter, life in the 8th Employment Company with life and death in the conscript armies of Germany, which so many of their schoolmates were forced to join. As Felix Werder, composer and music critic, reflects, it was all very unpleasant, unjust, even unethical, but not half as bad as being in a concentration camp, bombed out, or dying on the Stalingrad front of frostbite. The De Niro story attracts me for yet another reason. The questions we ask about the past always depend on where we're standing in the present. 70 years after that boatload of interned refugees reached Australia, we as a nation are much occupied with the issue of refugees arriving or trying to arrive by sea. In 2006, a number of De Niro boys appeared in a documentary film by the director John Bergen, first shown in Berlin, comparing the De Niro with the Tampa, that Norwegian freighter whose crew rescued hundreds of Hazara Afghans from a sinking ferry in the Indian Ocean. You'll recall that they weren't allowed to land on the Australian territory of Christmas Island and that eventually they were put ashore in Nauru, the first objects of what has come to be called the Pacific Solution. The film is entitled Friendly Enemy Alien. Its theme, I quote from the DVD jacket, is that the refugee, the unwanted outsider, presents a useful screen upon which to project all sorts of fears. Some De Niro boys have seen the film, resist what they see as a quite improper equation of themselves with Asian asylum seekers. Some who appear in the film say they wouldn't have been in it had they known what its theme was going to be. But Stephen Castles, distinguished practitioner of multicultural studies in Australia and England, recalls that his father, Heinz Schlösser, a German revolutionary socialist transported on the De Niro, taught him that Australia should be open to refugees. Nicholas Gruen, son of the eminent De Niro boy Fred Gruen, testifies that memories of his father's experience moved him to an active compassion for the refugees of his own generation. He has sponsored a teenage soccer team, the Hazara Tigers, from the ethnic group which haplessly precipitated our Pacific solution. When I met them, he writes, I was struck by how similar they were to how my father would have been. A thought similar to that has struck Nicholas Stern, Lord Stern, author of a momentous report on global warming, whose father, Adalbert Stern, a Jewish and socialist carpenter from Berlin, was a De Niro boy. Nicholas Stern and two brothers came out for the 70th anniversary celebrations at Hay. And she said to an Australian audience, whenever I hear people making derogatory remarks about asylum seekers, I think that's my dad. Would his dad have agreed? I don't know. But there's a sense in which Stephen Castles and Nicholas Gruen and Nicholas Stern might also be regarded as De Niro boys. Thanks.
That was Ken Inglis at the State Library of Victoria. You're on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National with me, Paul Barclay.